Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and eventually at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume and finish Chapter 6 of Anne Douglas's The Feminization of American Culture. We've been talking about death, funerals, and all the writing surrounding the sort of death culture and how it changed in the 1830s on. As they moved cemeteries from basically the churchyard in town to the outskirts of town and turned it into gardens and almost a sort of theme world or Disney-like experience for people back then where they could have emotional experiences. And this being something that, again, our theme here overall for the book is women and clergy trying to expand and enhance their status in a busy commercial American republic that's expanding and building in the formal business and politics that occupy the virile heterosexual men. So picking up on 256 and going through 272, we've got at least one, probably two subsections left. We did two last time. So 256, Prayers and Hymns, Exploration of Another World. The act of acquisition did not stop with the graveyard. During the middle decades of the 19th century, America was busy taking over territory on its boundaries. The studies of past conquests by the Romantic historians were paradigms for current aggression. A number of Americans, however, not apparently engaged or interested in these dramas of imperialism, were citing and colonizing territory theoretically of infinitely greater importance than the Southwest, heaven itself. Consolation literature of all forms between 1820 and 1875 became preoccupied not just with the last scenes and earthly resting places of the dead, but with their celestial destination and doings. William Holcomb, the author of Our Children in Heaven, expressed the need of, quote, some great spiritual telescope to bring the dead near to us in all their beautiful reality. The need of a, quote, clear, consistent, philosophical, authorized revelation of the life after death. This was easier to provide than at first might be imagined. Heaven was apparently as real, as concrete, as Texas, and heavenly prospects turned out to have as many affinities with domestic scenes. Or to have many affinities with domestic scenes. It is possible and even appropriate to describe this spiritualist annexation of heaven in the language of the modern media. The subgenre of consolation literature, dedicated to the definition and promulgation of praying and hymn singing, formed what we might call channels of communication to the other world. The writers of consolation literature established contact with the next world through prayers and hymns. Then, like modern television reporters, they pervade news of the heavenly realm back to earthly audiences. The authors of such accounts had enormous authority, for who could question their reports? The dead are like God, anyone can put words in their mouths. And for profit. No matter how genuine the need and belief of its proponents, the new domestic heaven was unquestionably the earliest, but in some sense the most perfect. Pseudo-event, in direct quotes, pseudo-event in American history. Totally fabricated, yet uncontestable. Prayer manuals, which appeared in ever greater numbers at mid-century, taught thousands of Americans, in the phrase of a later mind cure expert, to, quote, tune in with the infinite. An examination of the lives and motives of the authors of two of the most famous among them, The Still Hour and Stepping Heavenward, may help to explain their proliferation in this period. Typically, the earlier manual is a treatise by a man and a theologian. The second is a novel by a woman and a mother. As we saw in an earlier chapter, Austin Phelps had a close personal acquaintance with sickness and death. According to Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, her father was possessed of a divine instinct to relieve suffering, and he tended a succession of dying wives as well as his frail daughter. He founded the, quote, Improvement Association for the graveyard of his town. In his own view, he was a victim early consigned by a conspiracy of ill health and neurosis to the role of disestablished among the disestablished. As a young man, Phelps's frail constitution forced him to relinquish active pastoral duty in Boston. In middle age, he was seldom well enough to achieve the perfect fulfillment of his teaching and writing obligations at Andover Seminary, on which his conscience insisted. He wrote a self-pitying yet genuine piece entitled The Premature Closing of a Life's Work, which begins, quote, "Look around. You find the world full of those arrested, rebuffed, disappointed, though willing. Oh, how willing, workers." A number of Phelps's contemporaries apparently believed Phelps courted an invalid state. Certainly there are questions to ask about a man who, after nursing one wife in a fatal illness, would within a few years marry her sister, clearly marked as tubercular, and nurse her through the remaining 18 months of her life. So again, the association of Christianity getting off on sickness, illness, and death. Courting invalidism. What is clear is that in Phelps's mind, his suffering conferred on him a special status, even a special occupation. He liked to hope that, while he was excluded from the work of busier manhood, direct quote, he gained in spiritual vitality. It is not surprising that over the years, Phelps developed a stronger and stronger belief in the reality of the heavenly life and in the reality of prayer. He was open about the meaning of prayer in a life like his as an anticipation of powers not yet gained, a compensation for powers lost, as solace for the sick and therapy for life prisoners. Quote, "The value of prayer is as a means of usefulness to men whose life's work, like mine, is mainly finished. This oppressive sense of useless living is relieved by it." In 1860, a few years after the death of his second wife, Phelps published The Still Hour, or Communion with God, intended to help others learn how to pray. He frankly admitted that prayer was finally for the passive, that it was, in its highest conception, a state rather than an act. But he was also convinced that prayer has command of an immense reserve of yet undeveloped resources. In a later work, Phelps recounts a significant story about a sick and solitary woman who made a career of praying for everyone she knew. Again, like so many semi-spiritualists, drawing on a pseudo-scientific analogy, Phelps explains, "Her daily life is a line of telegraphic correspondences between this world and heaven. Her greatest triumph came when she prayed incessantly for a young man that she had never met, but whose accidental presence in a railroad car with her had revealed to her his religious crisis. She learned later that he had converted within a year and joined the ministry. Prayer allowed those excluded from the challenges of human history to participate in the miracles of divine providence." In her later years, Phelps was peculiarly impressed by the work of Elizabeth Prentice. Prentice's father, Edward Payson, a famous preacher in Portland, Maine, in the early 19th century, was himself noted for his spontaneous and heartfelt praying, what he called a kind of devout poetry. He died when Elizabeth was still a little girl of 8. Although she later fiercely resented comparisons between herself and her father, she cherished the memory of him all her life as a hero and a saint. Admitting that she had been particularly influenced by his devotional habits, she traced her own real spiritual development from the childhood moment when she had inadvertently rushed in on him, prostrate upon his face, completely lost in prayer. Like her father, Prentice was constantly subject to ill health, insomnia, and intense emotional conflict. She, too, was a creature of real talent, perhaps of genius. Unlike him, she had the full-time job of mother of a large family and knew the frustration consequent upon repressing very genuine and powerful artistic and ministerial impulses until nearly the end of her life. In the 1850s, Prentice lost a daughter and a son, and she sought comfort in books like Light on the Little Graves, The Folded Lamb, The Broken Bird, and Christian Consolation. Increasingly, Prentice found her outlet, and, like her father and like Austin Phelps, in prayer. She prayed incessantly on every subject, never stopping to think, as she said, quote, "if such and such a matter was sufficiently great for his, God's, notice." Prentice's last words to her husband shortly before she left for the Bible reading at which she would have her final collapse were a slow and emphasized injunction. Quote, "You pray one little prayer for me." Prentice's most popular novel, the partly autobiographical Stepping Heavenward, a book which Phelps read repeatedly with great admiration, is as surely a prayer manual as The Still Hour. Every word of that book, Prentice later explained, was a prayer. A clerical admirer described its impact. It was one of those books which sorrowing, Mary-like women read to each other and which lured many a bustling Martha from the fretting of her care-cumbered life to ponder the new lesson of rest in toil. The story concerns an overburdened doctor's wife whose piety is tested by her husband's insensitivity, her in-law's selfishness, and the agonizing death of one of her children. Its genuine force comes from Prentice's clear perception that the housewife's work is never finished, and hence never fully successful, satisfying, or rewarded. Katie Elliott masters one practical or familial problem only to have another crop up. The static moment of achievement, the well-earned narcissistic pause for applause, is by definition impossible. Prentice depicts the middle-class mother's life as one of harassment whose rewards are genuine but obscured. The motto of Stepping Heavenward can be summed up in the words of the heroine's mother. Go on praying. Pray without ceasing. Prayer provides, at a minimum, a little leisure, time off for self-involvement, no matter how lofty. But it is more. Significantly, Katie does not learn the true meaning of prayer and closeness to Christ until she is cut off from all household work by a painful 7-year illness, which, the reader assumes, terminates in her death. Needless to say, her family does not fully appreciate her until she abandons her status as semi-skilled wife and mother for the spiritual superiority of sainthood. Katie's last utterance, which closes the book, is, appropriately, a prayer expressing her thankfulness for God's grace. It is important that Katie's final prayer is also a poem couched in the stanzaic form of the hymn. As I have already said, Elizabeth Prentice's father, Edward Payson, had believed that prayer was devout poetry. Prentice loved hymns so much that at one time she felt herself in danger of preferring them even to the Bible. Discipline overcame this excessive predilection, but the passion for hymns remained. During Prentice's lifetime, American churchgoers came increasingly to identify prayers, poetry, and hymns. There are several points to be noted about the hymns which proliferated and were welcome in American homes and churches during this first period. First, their relative novelty is an important part of American Protestant worship. Second, their largely non-evangelical and feminine authorship. And last, their liberalized theology, poeticized form, and growing obsession with heavenly life. In Puritan days, congregations chanted hymns, which were drawn closely from the Psalms. Indeed, respect for the sacred word and a crude system of rhyme apparently necessitated a certain disrespect for easy comprehensibility. The Bay Psalm Book, first published in 1640, and standard in New England for nearly a century, the Bay Psalm Book, rendered the opening lines of the 23rd Psalm in rather literal fashion. The Lord to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall not I. Richard Mather, a member of one of New England's most illustrious clerical families, the Cotton Mather, in the Psalm Book's preface, quote, God's altar needs not our polishing. Another representative of the same family, Cotton Mather, who had done his own translation of the Psalms, thought, quote, a little more of art, not inappropriate, and watched with interest the changes that took place in hymnology during the late 17th and early 18th centuries. The great event for English hymnology during this period was the appearance of Isaac Watts's Hymns in 1707 and his Divine and Moral Songs in 1715, works destined to dominate hymn writing for nearly two centuries. Watts used only the suitable portions of psalms for his hymns, and on occasion loosely paraphrased those. His predecessors had felt committed to use every scrap of God's word, His successors were on occasion to desert Holy Writ altogether for secular sources. Watts, an English Anglican who tended toward proto-Unitarianism, Unitarian, I always think liberal, almost Christianity without Christ is budding. The liberalization is associated with Unitarian, even today, especially even. But as late, you know, even into the 1700s. Watts, an English Anglican who tended toward proto-Unitarianism, was perfectly aware of the transformation he was encouraging. He admitted that he had, quote, brought down the royal author into the common affairs of the Christian life. And remember, Martin Luther, who kicked off Protestantism in the 1500s, wrote a lot of prayers, or I'm sorry, a lot of hymns. So Watts is kind of doing the same thing. They're making it more secular. They start with sort of almost clunky, chunky stuff, but it's directly from the Bible, so how can it be wrong? But then they increasingly, they're given over to more artistic concern. They can't help but want to make it better, you know, in that way. And they start maybe moving away from the direct words of the Bible, is what she's saying here. If men were to sing about God, it must be in terms and tunes they understood and enjoyed. Initial approval of Watts was cautious in the colonies. The first American edition appeared in Boston in 1739. Philadelphia issued one in 1742, New York in 1752. Cotton Mather was very enthusiastic about Watts's hymns, but thought them suitable for private rather than public services. Indeed, says Douglas, it is crucial for understanding the role of hymns, in the changing American Protestant Church, to remember that they were originally conceived as best adapted for domestic and familial rather than communal and ecclesiastical uses. So these are kind of like private helpers for keeping people orthodox and transmitting the lessons and encouraging a love of the church, maybe. These two hymns are more private than public. It was only when the church itself had been redefined in domestic terms that hymns could be central to their forms of worship. So as religion goes from a very, very serious public thing to a more domestic, feminine, comfortable thing, it goes by degree, by degree, by degree over time is what we're seeing in all these different things. A conservative congregationalist like Joel Hawes, Bushnell's rival in Hartford, bowed to the new fashion with extreme and open reluctance. And these are some of the people I'm descended from. And I mean, I could totally see myself. I would have been one of the hard asses in preaching the, like, no, you're making a mistake when you do that. You're lowering your standard, and it feels good. But in the end, it's just leading to the same old problems. So I would have been one of those hard ass types. You know, that's history. You see your own kind of people. And I don't talk about that too much because I don't know those people very much. This is many hundreds of years ago. And they, the ones of mine that were English ancestors came over on the Mayflower, and they were Congregationalist preachers, at least one or two of them. So it's easy to think about this from that point of view. Now, let's see. So Joel Hawes is a conservative congregationalist, and he bows to the new hymn fashion with extreme and open reluctance. After a hymn had been sung, Hawes customarily announced with some acerbity that divine services would now recommence. Now you can kind of see this skinny guy making this wry sort of statement. Now we'll get back to God's. To God's word from that clownage. And that's the basic hardcore masculine rigorous approach that is never popular and always needed, whether in religion or in anything else. Watts became the standard authority, but his very example inspired successors and imitators. He had demonstrated, as the Wesley brothers also did in the mid-18th century, that hymn writing was a human endeavor, a form of literature, of authorship. The Congregationalists of Connecticut put out the Hartford Selection in 1799. Timothy Dwight, the Congregationalist Pope, quote-unquote, of Connecticut, published his very popular selections in 1807, mainly drawn from Watts and his school. With the end of church establishment, when it's not formally set up by and funded by the government, that is, and the spread of denominational rivalry as the American Protestant modus vivendi, every sect had its own hymn book. And notice, we've talked about that in earlier sessions, that when you go from having one funded church in a particular colony or community, when you make it a matter of free agency and people can choose between churches and there's competition, excuse me, you're setting the churches on a path to Joel Osteenward, let's just say. Because not everything in life, you're used to hearing competition produces the best, and in many ways that's true if you're trying to supply gum or you know, baked beans or something. But in some things, is there anything humans need that's not popular, but they still need it? And the height of that would be fidelity and morality, the hard, stern virtues. So if you're going to get into a source battle where people can choose, they're going to tend to go to the ones that tell them what they want to hear. And that's as true in religion as anything else. So the softer preachers are going to win more people than the hard, rigorous ones, at least when you start from a very hard, rigorous base. Now, it may take 200 years to fully degrade to today, where they won't tell you anything you don't want to hear. And then the harder core ones become more attractive again, because that's what you can't get. And you can get that soft, easy, degenerate tolerance everywhere. You see, these are tricky matters. What we want and what we need are not necessarily the same thing. Anyway, so the hymns are part of the softening. They're a little more secular. I mean, very, very small degree. They're not in any way degenerate or anything, but they're basically opening the door through which more degenerate forms could come, stuff that's farther and farther away from the actual words of the Bible. With the end of church establishment and the spread of denominational rivalry, as the American Protestant modus vivendi, every sect had its own hymn book. Even Aidan Ballou's Universalist and Communal followers had their special collection entitled The Hopedale Collection of Hymns and Songs, 1845. The fact remains, however, that from the start of the 19th century, certain sects were clearly dominant in the writing and publishing of hymns in the Northeast. The Episcopalians, for obvious reasons, tended to be conservative in their choices. The Presbyterians, who retained a clearer emphasis on the sermon and the spoken word than many of their rival Protestant sects, were not particularly fruitful in hymns. The Baptists developed a compelling brand of emotional folk song hymn, but its popularity was largely in the South and Southwest. All historians of the subject seem in agreement that the Unitarians, aided and abetted by liberal Congregationalists and what Theodore Cuyler called godly women writers, produced more popular hymns of high quality than any other sect. Between 1830 and 1865, the Unitarians published 15 separate hymn books. Henry Ware, Jr., William Peabody, and F.W.P. Greenwood were among the editors and authors. In 1855, Henry Ward Beecher helped to put together the Plymouth Collection, probably the most important hymn book of the mid-century period. More and more Protestants were singing more and more hymns written by Unitarians, like-minded Congregationalists, and women. And hymns are very important to church and worship in general. I mean, I can still remember many of them from going to Christian Science Sunday School, and I didn't mind singing. I liked singing them. You know, I didn't believe that they contained any particular sense. They were basically happy-ass shit that people want to believe that isn't true, but still, it's fun to sing with others or by yourself. Singing is one of the lubricants of life, which is, in many ways, is tawdry and wearing. I think you'll agree. The special trademarks of these hymns were their literary quality and their tendency to stress the more cheerful aspects of Protestant theology. And remember, this is coming from a sinner's in the hands of an angry God. Ye are so many tent worms over a grate of a barrel burr, burning with evil papers. I don't know why God doesn't smite you down. God knows you deserve it. That was their tenor. And that more or less, in my opinion, is what people need to hear. It's not really precisely true, but you need to smack those bitches into line. Changing funerary practices were intended to rob death of its proverbial sting. And see, this is the lesson here in the Learning College. You find something that's valid, worthwhile, really, truly good, and identify the standards needed to uphold it, and uphold those motherfuckers. That's what the world doesn't have enough of. You understand? That's the true lesson here. Not the only one, but that's a major lesson here that we get from watching Protestantism become looser, laxer, and completely set. It really creates, builds. It basically is like the guy who designs and sets up the stage for the Jews who would come to take it over in the 20th century, and real experts in the dark side stuff. As the Protestants self-unstring, the Jews really help rip the corset all the way off. So identifying standards and upholding them is a large part of what you need to do to be serious, to be a serious person. So the hymns become slightly more secular and more cheerful than homilies and preaching generally were. Changing funerary practices were intended to rob death of its proverbial sting. Hymnology facilitated the process by ignoring hell and highlighting heaven. Hymns were increasingly viewed as performing a very different function from that of the sermon they might accompany. Austin Phelps, who helped to write the single most important treatise on hymnology in America in the 19th century, explained to his readers that the subject of a sermon is not necessarily appropriate to a hymn. Hymns, in his opinion, express, quote, the heart of the church. Hymns express the heart of the church. As such, they should not have an excess of the analytic element. They should be well-written, tasteful, beautiful. Their purpose is to inspire and uplift, cheer. They are to act as a kind of tonic to the worshiper. Hymns were not, in other words, to be intellectual. Phelps was using hymns to further and define that split between the theology of the intellect and the theology of the feelings, which his colleague at Andover, Edward A. Park, had enunciated. So there's a theology of the intellect, theology of the feelings, and we heard about that earlier. If Phelps found all conceptualizing foreign to a proper and successful hymn, he held one brand of speculation uniquely inappropriate, that which deals with hell or damnation, reminding his readers that the scriptures inculcate a faith which worketh by love. He urged that comminatory or threatening hymns should be very rare, hymns that talk about you're going to hell if you don't do this, or maybe the dear dead departed is in hell already, screaming in anguish as you sing your lovely hymn. Earlier hymnologists had hardly agreed. In 1758, Samuel Davies, the president of Princeton, had penned a hymn containing these grim lines on the fate of the damned. In vain for mercy now they cry, in lakes of liquid fire they lie. I can do better than that. In vain for mercy, I always tend to go to a little madness now and then is relished by the wisest man. From Roald Dahl. But anyway, so this guy, just imagine this guy at his desk writing this hymn. This is awesome. Now this is the kind of sermon I personally would want to attend. Someone who thinks like this. In vain for mercy they now cry, in lakes of liquid fire they lie. Can you imagine one of these modern? You've ever been to a church, and you know it just as prison has its own mental atmosphere that you immediately sink into when you're thrown into, which is an us them and be tough, be on guard, and everybody's hostile to everybody else. So do churches have that rah-rah, happy-ass feeling to them. And imagine singing a hymn like that in a church. In vain for mercy now they cry, in lakes of liquid fire they lie. That is great. I would dig singing that in church. Oh my God, that's funny. And yet, you know, they say the way is narrow. So objectively, that must be true. If their other stuff's right, then that is an inevitable conclusion that most of the departed are, in fact, in hell. As someone said, logic is not a bus you can get off wherever you want. It goes to the end of the goddamn stop. If the gates are narrow, then most must not make it to heaven. And if they don't make it to heaven, they must go to hell. There ain't no in-between. And why would we want to exclude that most important truth from our hymns? Phelps was able to quote numerous lines from Watts, which he pronounced unfit for a Christian hymn. Lines about eternal plagues and heavy chains, tormenting racks and fiery coals, or lines entailing enforced confessions on the part of the singer that, quote, 'Twas I that shed the sacred blood. I nailed him to the tree. I crucified the Christ of God. I joined the mockery. Calmly overriding the examples of Dante and Milton, Phelps explained that actual intangible horrors do not belong to poetry. See, this is something that is degrading, and it's kind of funny, but degrading almost always means like feeling good at any cost. Intellectual honesty or bodily health or whatever. Just do your own thing, man. Hey, man, it doesn't make me happy to hear about fire and people being tormented in lakes of fire. I want a poem. I want hymns and poetry that make me feel good. This is what feminization of any institution always brings. And remember, that is the subject after all this book, the feminization of American culture. And that's what, as I've said many times, Florence King said, when women take over an institution, it's moribund. That's a word that means dying or ending. It's good years are behind it, and it's now on the downside. Because why is that? Because the standards are gone. And ironically, we have a feminist here who is adhering to very high intellectual standards. She's one of the few who is honest enough to realize that these were serious people back then. And she's essentially she is essentially providing us a good history of how Protestantism became less and less intellectually serious, less and less character-rigorous. And you see how neatly, this may seem very far afield from what we generally talk about at the Learning College, but it's not at all. It's showing the prototype of the mentality and the social patterns that would come to full Jewy fruition in the 20th century. And now, as I happen to be telling you this in 2017 as I'm reading this, it's even worse. Well, this is the origins of the mental ways and life ways and cultural ways that we opened up that made us easy prey for the Jews, who did it more organized, systematically, and quick in the process, especially when they got the new technology that came in the early decades of the 20th century. So, 'twas I that shed the sacred blood. I nailed him to the tree. I crucified the Christ of God. I joined the mockery. Calmly overriding, this is a nice example of her wry wit. Calmly overriding the examples of Dante and Milton. Again, Dante writing about the nine circles of hell. You know, some of the top literature ever written, Milton and Paradise Lost. Calmly overriding the examples of Dante and Milton, Phelps explained that actual intangible horrors do not belong to poetry. Is that right? You know, of the movie Back to School, he's like, mafia. And he did it in that Bush-like way of deliberately mispronouncing the vowel sound, like Bush would say Saddam instead of Saddam, just to insult him. Or the way George Allen, the president of the Redskins, called him Kurt Cousins rather than Kirk because he wouldn't sign their cheap contract, a technique he picked up from the Jew Al Davis, who used to do that with the Oakland Raiders. He says, the very waspy sort of, or waspy, Anglo-waspy French-type guy who's opposed to the The rich guy, what's his name? Rodney Dangerfield, the dead Jew, who's the one, the hero of Back to School. He's like, mafia bribes and corrupt whatever are not part of the way we do business here. He's just ignoring reality. Are not part of any business world, and certainly not part of anything we're teaching here at this institution. After Dangerfield, who was a real-life successful businessman in the movie, had explained how it actually works. It's a comedy. You must have seen the film, but anyway, that kicks in here. And this clown, like the clown, is saying that hell and stuff like that is no part of anything we're teaching here in this church, or we're putting in this hymn. He says actual intangible horrors do not belong to poetry. So he's basically saying that Dante is not a poet or an artist. So he's being a clown. He's saying that Christianity, it's sort of the modern version of this. You don't love, Jesus said to love every, Christianity is all about love. There's no hate or standards or rigor in it. It's just about love. If you don't love homosexuals, you're not a real Christian. Well, this is an early proto example of that type of mentality. Now, great, it's a one degree. And it's in the very simplest form, you can see how that would develop. That pro-homo part would develop out of this. Well, death and hell don't have any part of what we're teaching here at this church. And then he turns back to the class. He's like, now where should we build our factory? And Dangerfield responds, how about building in Fantasyland? Which is particularly funny. If you don't think death and hell are part of Christianity and part of real psychological reality of this stuff, you're in fantasy land. You see? No Christian could revel in song on such a theme or clutch at details of modes and instruments of torture. Phelps wrote that, quote, sacred song instinctively looks heavenward. Phelps also notes that hymns on heaven are innumerable, and a study of dozens of the most popular hymn books of the period confirms his opinion. In 1818, Congregationalist William Tappan, T-A-P-P-A-N, wrote a popular hymn called Heaven, A Place of Rest, whose title might as well have served for hundreds of the popular hymns which succeeded it. The kindest remark an admirer could apparently make about a hymn composer was the one Dr. Charles S. Robinson made about Thomas Hastings. Quote, his poems breathe the very air of heaven. Reverend Kyler praised William Muhlenberg, an Episcopalian rector who wrote the well-loved hymn, I Would Not Live Always, for his, quote, heavenly mindedness. In, quote, Like Noah's Weary Dove, Muhlenberg exhorts his soul, the dove, to fly through, quote, the open door into the, quote, the ark of God. Fanny Crosby, the blind poet who wrote hymns for Moody and Sankey later in the century, emoted joyously in 1858. We are going to a home beyond the skies where the fields are robed in beauty and the sunlight never dies. I don't care how dumb anything is. I love singing it. It's just fun. We are going to a home beyond the skies where the fields are robed in beauty and the sunlight never dies. The fields are full of little men sitting upon toadstools. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of The Wizard of Oz. The subject of such hymns is not simply heaven, but its accessibility. The home of which Crosby writes was to be taken in a rather literal sense by many of her contemporaries. In The Still Hour, Austin Phelps explained that an astronomer does not turn his telescope to the skies with a more reasonable hope of penetrating those distant heavens than I have of reaching the mind of God by lifting up my heart at the throne of grace. Phelps's analogy suggests again the pseudo-scientific spirit of assurance which the writers of consolation literature brought to the subject of heaven. Somewhat as we might follow on television the lunar expeditions of our modern astronauts, mid-19th century Americans mourning their dead were encouraged to follow their journey to heaven in minutest detail. To inquire what they ate for breakfast, who they met, how they lived. The consolatory books of the afterlife increasingly promised them that such facts were part of available knowledge. In the 1880s, Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, carrying her father's analogy to its logical extreme, produced two novels, Beyond the Gates and Between the Gates, which set forth the eating habits, occupations, lifestyles, and methods of childcare and courtship current in Avon. She even described with some care and a ratio Beethoven had just composed for a celestial audience. The only inquiry she could not answer was the natural one, quote, touching the means by which her deceased narrator, a male physician, was, quote, unable to give this record to the living earth.
Where does ye come by your knowledge? Well, I pulled it out of me ass, if ye must know.
That is the only secret which, as she says in the last line of Between the Gates, she decides to let, quote, remain such. I mean, clowns will have their clownage. That ends that little subsection. Now we'll go on to the last one, just a few pages. Heaven Our Home, The Colonization of the Afterlife. The debate over the afterlife, to which the consolation literature made such an interesting contribution, had a complex history in American and European thought. The debate over the afterlife. Medieval Christians had shown an intense interest in the next world, an interest which generated a special, popular, and long-enduring literary genre, the monastic vision. Footnote 70. Yet built into this tradition was the notion that heaven itself was finally forbidden to human eyes. During and after the Reformation, Christian thinkers and believers showed an increasing preoccupation with the doctrine of the millennium, that period of 1,000 years before the last judgment in which Christ and his saints would rule on earth. Millennial speculation was particularly intense in America. Many could not help associating the birth of this new nation with more general and religious possibilities of regeneration. Jonathan Edwards was not alone in hoping that America might be the chosen site of the millennial rule. Like if Jesus came back to earth, he would come to America, because it's so fresh and spunky. Before the Civil War, American Christians tended to be millenarians. Again, millenarianism or millennialism or chiliasm are all kind of the same thing for the end times. He's coming back. He's coming back. The belief that there's going to be an end times and that Jesus is going to come back. Although they split into two deeply opposed camps, premillenarians, usually members of the less educated and more evangelical sects, Baptist, who believed that Christ would come to earth suddenly, even unexpectedly, at the start of the millennium, to supervise its unfolding. He's going to reign for 1,000 years. Why is it a millennium? A thousand. Post-millenarians, the post-millenarians who held that Christ would not appear until the end of the 1,000-year period. So there's a 1,000-year period he's going to reign. Is he going to come before that? Or 1,000 years of peace or whatever. He's going to come before that or after that. So the posties think he's coming after, leaving men to guess and execute his wishes in a more gradual and less dramatic fashion. In 1878, a special convocation of clergymen from more traditional groups met in Chicago to uphold premillennial views. Strikingly, those responsible and those attending were almost entirely of the evangelical sects. Presbyterians, noted for their orthodoxy here as elsewhere, dominated. There were few Episcopalians, few Congregationalists, and no Unitarians. Unitarian thought on the subject is typified by F.W.P. Greenwood, who, several decades earlier, had dismissed the millennium altogether and referred to the judgment day as figurative, emblematic only of Christ's coming in our hearts. The proponents of premillennialism, could be very astute about analyzing the thinking and motives of their post-millennial foes. If you want to know the basic truth about someone, ask their enemy. It's part of that. George Duffield, a Presbyterian minister and hymn writer, in his 1842 treatise on the Second Coming of Jesus Christ, notes that every post-millennial organizer of missionary work hopes, quote, to see his church assume ascendant influence and lead the way to the millennium. In 1840, Reverend J.W. Brooks, fighting those who disregard the millennium because they cannot see the practical use of the doctrine, reminds them that utility is ultimately irrelevant. Quote, men do not recognize the chief and all-important feature of the Bible, he thunders, that it is not the word of man, but the word of God. Nathaniel West, who attended the premillennial conference, also lamented, quote, the mistaken system of spiritualizing and accommodating Bible language. It is Charles Hodge versus Edwards A. Park once again. Is man dependent finally on God or God on man? Is God's word dogma or literature? Yet the differences between premillenarians and postmillenarians were not as great as they seemed. Both groups had increasingly confused the millennial period with the heavenly afterlife, and in doing so had sacrificed the Augustinian and Puritan stress on the importance of the Last Judgment and the commanding role an autocratic and even alien deity played in it. Furthermore, both groups increasingly shared a conviction that this earth, purified and transfigured, would be the locus of the millennium. Henry F. Hill, writing in 1853 on The World to Come, staunchly attacks the postmillenarians. He reminds his readers that the world is still full of evil and will require dramatic and divine aid to achieve millennial status. He warns that even ministers may be mistaken and that, quote, the preaching of peace is a snare. Yet he believes and claims most ministers believe that the earth, quote, purified indeed and beautified, but retaining its materialism, will be the site of our millennial and heavenly existences. Despite his orthodox stress on God's will, he is still willing to admit that it is enacted totally in man's sphere and in man's terms. Hill, for all his premillennial zeal, was careful to promise his readers, the faculties of the mind are not to perish with this mortal life. The indescribable love of home planted in the human heart, rendering even trivial things around the homestead sacred and endearing, will not only live, but increase in the resurrection state. If millennial and heavenly lives were not clearly separated, this world and the next were inevitably more and more closely, if unintentionally, assimilated to one another. The millennial debate became part of a larger discussion over the nature of heaven. Kingdom or home? American ministers of the 17th and 18th centuries had given relatively little attention to the subject. When they spoke of the next life, it was hardly in terms to attract the carnal heart. Nathaniel Emmons had remarked in one of his grimmer sermons, the truth is that there is nothing which God requires men to do in this life in order to go to heaven that is harder to be done than to be willing to be in heaven. Emmons attributed this aversion to men because he looked upon the next world as the Lord's possession, and as such, a landscape inevitably foreign to mortalize. There were men and women to uphold at least a portion of this view in the northeastern United States at mid-century, but they were in a clear minority, and confused at best. George Cheever, a popular and reform-minded Congregationalist minister of the New York City, in his book, The Powers of the World to Come, 1853, stressed the glory of the afterlife. Putting the judgment in central place in his celestial picture, he visualizes the regenerate souls passing eternity in the act of worship and praise of God in the most traditional theocentric way. Yet despite all his highlighting of God's omnipotence, Cheever still tries to reconcile divine glory with very human domestic needs. He promises his readers that heaven is not the dim, incomprehensible universality of omnipresence merely, but a place for our abode, as determined a place is for us now, and with as intimate a home circle as the dearest fireside on earth can have, nay, incomparably more intimate and personal, and definitely local in our Father's house in heaven. You just have to wonder at people who are willing to base their entire lives on something that is pure speculation. There's not one whit of proof or even evidence of, I would say evidence, but people have low standards for evidence, so they claim there is evidence, but it's completely baseless. They're simply making all this up and then basing their lives on it. So really, in a way, when I'm judging them, it's like judging them the way you would judge science fiction when I'm talking about degradation from standards. Like they say, you can have any world you want to create, but your actions and your movement within that world have to be consistent. You're going to claim, okay, if you accept the Christian system as written down in the Bible, well, then you have to be true to that. And you're being false to that when you say, oh, there's a heaven and a hell, and most are going to go to hell, but then we exclude hell from our hymns. You've made yourself a clown. Now, your whole greater system may be clownage, whatever you believe, but if you're not even sticking to your own stated facts and standards about your fictional world, then you're a double clown in a way, or certainly you're a clown within your own system, leaving aside the question of whether your greater belief is fraudulent. So, heaven is to reunite families. It even offers nurseries for children who die before their parents. Among non-evangelical groups, the out-and-out supporters of a domestic heaven were dominant. Andrew Peabody, F.W.P. Greenwood, The Wares, Charles Follen, William E. Channing, and Austin Phelps, to name just a few, believed that heavenly life satisfied the human heart as presently constituted, that it offered homes restored, families regathered, and friends reunited. Intimate speculation about heavenly scenes became common in the consolation literature of the period. So they're going on and on. They're envisioning. I mean, this is to my mind, the white mind, sort of the flip side of its creativity is it's almost bizarre or morbid fascination with things that don't exist. But that's not the morbidity. The morbidity is believing they're real, even though there's no evidence they're real. There's no evidence for any of this. And yet, people are literally writing 100-page novels about this stuff. How insane is that? To me, that's insane. Maybe not in a dangerous way, but not in a good way. It's true because they want to believe it's true. That's really what binds them. Wouldn't you like to believe? And I had one put it to me that way. Wouldn't you like to believe? ... Why is it a matter of what I would like to believe rather than a matter of objective fact? Wouldn't I like to believe in snow? Well, why is it a matter of whether I'd like to believe it or not? I've seen snow. I've felt it. I've rolled around in it. Snow exists. It has distinctive properties. So it's not a matter of whether I'd like to believe it. Now, you talk about this heaven. It sounds very dubious and doubtful to me. It sounds like something you'd want to believe. But, you know, if you have something to show me that shows that it's real, then I might accept it. I'd have to accept it. What do you got? Well, with this book here talks about it, explains it. Well, who wrote that book? Well, God wrote that. God wrote that book. How about that? First shot, and he's an international bestseller. That's something there. Maybe you do have something. All right. Intimate speculation about heavenly scenes became common in the consolation literature of the period. In the later 1850s, a few daring souls began to write novels about heaven. Given the tradition of the novel, to write a novel about anything was, in a sense, to domesticate it, to bring it from the church congregation to the family circle. No one was better aware of this than Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, who took heaven as her fictional specialty, to the delight of hundreds of thousands of Americans, and the scorn of Mark Twain. So she's writing the same time as Mark Twain. Phelps's bestseller, The Gates Ajar, was published in 1868. Two other books on the same subject followed it in the 1880s, but she was still able to claim, rightly, that her views were still what they had been in 1868 when she was only 24. Phelps was the descendant not just of Austin Phelps and Moses Stuart, but of 10 generations of congregational ministers and deacons. Phelps is a good Welsh name, I believe. She would undoubtedly have been a minister if such a path had been open to her. In girlhood, while her two brothers played at mock sermons, she turned to literary preaching. Self-consciously plain, reform-minded, over-earnest, nearly an invalid from neuralgia and insomnia, she did not marry until 44, and the world laughed, for her husband, Herbert Ward, was 17 years her junior, an aspiring writer clearly more drawn to her literary success than her personal charms. The marriage was not happy. In The Gates Ajar, Phelps quotes from a Scottish divine who speculated that, quote, heaven may be a place for those who failed on earth. Though Phelps was hardly a failure, her books sold well throughout her life, she had missed not just love, but fulfillment. Seldom likable, always a sentimental writer, often a sloppy one, her formidable talent sat by her need of self-justification, she received little real personal or critical esteem. She came increasingly, if comprehensibly, to see herself as a vehicle of suffering. In 1889, she wrote in a clear mood of self-revelation about the point when pain ceases in any real sense to be profitable. Quote, there comes a limit beyond which the best that fate could offer could not atone for the worst she had inflicted. Believing that God has chosen to impose on his creatures the final test of love, trust under apparent desertion, Phelps also stressed, with a certain bitter animus, that he has pledged them all the redress in his power. If earth is an orphanage, heaven surely must be the home in every sense of the word. Heaven surely must be home in every sense of the word. No one was more committed to the denial of death as a separate state than Phelps. In 1885, she published an extraordinary volume entitled Songs of the Silent World, filled with reassuring poems supposedly written by dead people to their living and grieving relatives. An imaginary trusting survivor expresses Phillips's credo in the best poem of the book. There is no vacant chair. The loving meet. A group unbroken, smitten, who knows how. One sitteth silent only in his usual seat. We gave him once that freedom. Why not now? Death is a mood of life. It is no whim by which life's giver mocks a broken heart. Death is life's reticence, still audible to him. The hushed voice, happy, speaketh on, apart. The Gates Ajar is posited on this hopeful, literal-minded assurance, and it constitutes the apotheosis of the consolation literature of the day. The book appropriately focuses on the conflict among the would-be consolers of Mary, a New England girl who has lost her adored brother in the Civil War. On one side, there is Dr. Bland, the local Calvinist minister, who preaches of a cold and abstract heaven as an eternal state where the regenerate shall study with the character and God. On the other is Mant's Aunt Winifred, who believes in a thoroughly concrete and domestic heaven where dead soldiers will chat with President Lincoln and culturally starved girls will have pianos to play. Heaven, in Winifred's view, is a consolation prize. Mary herself is an easy convert to this view. After long talks with her aunt in the local graveyard, she is reconciled to the loss of her brother precisely because she realizes that she has not lost him at all. Adopting the confusion of heavenly and earthly spheres, which is Winifred's credo, Mary comes to believe her brother is watching her, waiting for her. It only takes a domestic tragedy to bring Dr. Bland, following the rest of the town, into Winifred's camp. When his wife burns to death, he craves comfort, and only Winifred's belief can supply it. Again, it's what people want to believe. There's always a market to sell people what they want to believe rather than what they need to hear. Winifred, like her author, is not satisfied, however, with the control of the souls of her townsmen. She wants the souls of her readers as well. All the logic of The Gates Ajar, as of the consolation literature of which it is the culmination, suggests to the reader, you are going to end up, if you are well-behaved and lucky, in a domestic realm of children, women, and ministers, i.e. angels, so why not begin to believe in them now? Phelps has at her disposal a bid for power which, if ignored, could become a threat of revenge. Phelps's bid is formidable, however. The bribe she offers her readers is the enormous, intimate, domestic detail of her heaven. Reading the book is somewhat like a window shopping outside the fanciest stores on Fifth Avenue. It is the confidently precise information about the rewards of celestial life which makes this book and its successors such extraordinary documents of American religious and cultural history. The world may be imaginary, but they've got all the details printed down to make it seem real. Aunt Winifred predicts with assurance that her hair will no longer be gray, quote, in heaven, that heaven will look, like to her at least, like Kansas, the state she loves best. She teaches her little girl Faith to talk confidently to her dead father and to expect that God will give her everything she wants, even her favorite cookies, in heaven. Phelps's sequels to The Gates Ajar prove Winifred's staggering assurances to be modest understatements. The narrator of Beyond the Gates finds herself, after her death, in a lovely, semi-rural, graciously suburban landscape. A kindly angel escorts her to the new house, which is in every sense a home. Quote, "We stopped before a small and quiet house built of curiously inlaid woods. So exquisite was the carving and the coloring that on a larger scale the effect might have interfered with the solidity of the building, but so modest were the proportions of this charming house that its dignity was only enhanced by its delicacy. It was shielded by trees. There were flowers, not too many, birds, and I noticed a fine dog sunning himself on the steps. I strolled across the little lawn and stood uncertain at the threshold. The dog arose as I came up and met me cordially." Inside, she finds, quote, "much of the familiar furniture of a modest home, as well as beautiful objects which are strange to her. Her deceased father, who has long been living there and waiting for her, comes to meet her. He is glad, in a tellingly bourgeois phase, to have, quote, somebody to come home to." Earlier in this chapter, I compared the authors of consolation literature to politicians campaigning for new votes in fresh territories and to imperialists annexing new continents. But the sentimentalists, invading as they did a totally imaginary land, had in one sense an easier time of it than either politicians or imperialists usually do. They did not have to win over or subdue a hostile populace. Their new supporters were just like themselves. Their new country was home. They had no obstacles to overcome, and their imaginary kingdom reflected that fact. Ownership, not acquisition or effort, is its law. Therein lay the source of its widespread appeal to Victorian and post-Victorian America. Phelps, like the other authors of consolation literature, had an immense interest in visualizing the afterlife as being scaled to domestic and pastoral proportion, as a place where she would dominate rather than be dominated. In doing so, she documented the enticingly effortless and inevitable preeminence of the average. The rise in the mass. Ortega y Gasset would talk about the revolt in the masses or the domination of the masses, low mass taste. And not only the abandonment, but the denial of higher standards. This is where it begins to form. In doing so, she documented the enticingly effortless and inevitable preeminence of the average. She dilated heavenly time. She blew up that anticipated moment whose meaning she could legislate. An early practitioner of the art of soap opera, she was fascinated by the inertia of the prolonged close-up. The anthropomorphizing instinct can go no further, for the next world is here known with an intimacy which only possession can bestow. Spiritualism is paradoxically the logical facade of materialism. The unknown objects and possibilities in the modest house and beyond the gates suggest no break with its earthly counterpart, but rather the mysterious glorification inherent in the process by which an impermanent object becomes permanent. The occupants of Phelps's heaven, engaged in good works, keeping up with earthly news, redecorating their homes, falling in love and gratifying their various tastes, live in a celestial retirement village. They constitute a consecrated leisure society. The carefully contrived world of the dead in heaven, as in the rural cemetery, a world created in protest against the larger competitive society, in actuality served to transfer, isolate, and protect what would become the most essential ritual of that society. The chaos of productivity is eliminated in order to ensure the pleasures of consumption. Consumption without the effort of productivity. That's the end of chapter 6 of The Feminization of American Culture. I've been reading to you from Ann Douglas, a book that was published back in 1977. Great work. We've made our way 272 pages out of about roughly 400 that we can read, and there are various notes and bibliography and index, but we're getting towards about three quarters of the way through it. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me today. I really enjoyed reading this to you, and I'll be back with you again, and we'll do more from the feminization of American culture real soon.